Hello, my name is Donovan Bigelow, and this is a lecture on Freud, the classic psychoanalytic approach. And it's important to talk about where psychology came from. I think it's fairly clear to most clinicians today that all psychology is either a direct or indirect derivative of Freud's original ideas, or a response to or reaction to or a rejection of Freud's ideas. But it seems like in order to understand the current state of psychology, we have to know where it all started, and I don't think there's much disagreement that it all started with Freud. Now, I think I have to up front talk about Freud criticism, because over the last 40 or 50 years, Freud has come in for rather vicious criticism, some legitimate, some almost scurrilous, some ideological, some profound and important. And I think it's important that we sort of spend a few minutes sort of situating not just Freud, but Freud criticism. First of all, I don't think anybody ever criticized Freud more than Freud himself. It's simply not realistic to say, well, Freud said this, therefore he was wrong or he was right. Freud was always changing his views. He evolved, he grew, he integrated, he developed. It isn't really realistic to say, well, Freud was wrong about this, Freud was wrong about that, because he himself said, I was wrong about this or that, as he moved through the decades. He worked for over 50 years in studying, researching, in his clinical work and other theoretical writings, what the human mind is all about. And you can always find in almost any text of Freud, and his collected works are 23 volumes of hardback writings, thick volumes, many of them. You can always find Freud criticizing his earlier writings. So it's more important to keep in mind that he fully intended not a body of doctrine, but he intended, more than anything else, a method, a way of thinking about the human mind. Friedrich Nietzsche, the great German philosopher of the early, mid-1880s, said, all great truths are methods. And so this may be the most important element of this opening discussion, is you must understand that it wasn't the content of Freud's earlier ideas that are really worth criticizing. He criticized them himself later. What may be the most important thing to understand is what Freud laid down, what Freud suggested, and what he worked on consistently throughout his life was a method of the exploration of the mind. One of the modern thinkers on Freudianism, a man named Dr. Robert Kaper, said it as well as anyone, and I quote, "Psychoanalysis is not a philosophical school with a body of canonical tenets, but rather an empirical approach to the mind with its own specific clinical methodology." That sounds a little thick, but he means the same thing I just said. The idea that to criticize a specific theory or specific element of Freud's metapsychology is kind of beside the point. We have to look deeper. We have to look broader. I must also address feminist critiques of Freud, because I think that's been central to Freud criticism in the last 40 or 50 years. People have said that Freud was sort of an anti-feminist, that he was a misogynist, that he was anti-women. And I think it's hard for me to imagine anyone saying that who's actually read Freud's work and understood where he was in his particular cultural milieu. I may take the radical position that Freud was a proto-feminist. I know, given the readings of that time, that he was the only physician in Europe who took women seriously. Everyone else at the time, treating women's hysteria, which is what they called it then, assumed that women were hysterical because they were constitutionally weak, that there was something about hysteria that was simply a woman's disease and women were prone to it because, you know, they were just the way they are. We could understand that from lesser creatures. That was the misogynistic attitude of virtually all of Europe. And Freud was the only physician to stop, to wait, to think, to take his female patients seriously, to ask questions about what was in their minds, what were they thinking, how did they come to think this way, how did they come to feel this way, what experiences had they had in their early families, in their early childhood developments. I don't think it's beyond, it is, I think, beyond doubt that Freud was the first physician in Europe to take his women patients seriously, to respect their minds, to be curious about how their minds worked, and perhaps what was troubling their minds. I think I'll use the analogy that that Sir Isaac Newton used. When someone praised him for being so smart, Sir Isaac Newton is alleged to have said, "If I have seen farther than others, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants." Well, the truth is, most people who criticize Freud today don't seem to recognize that inevitably they are standing on his shoulders. He, I believe, is a world historical genius that in 1,000 years, in 2,000 years, people will still be reading Freud's works and wondering about their impact on our understanding of the mind. In fact, there's a brand new translation coming out. A psychoanalyst named Mark Solms is just in the next year or so completing a completely new translation of the original German. The English translations that we have since the early 1950s were translated as well as they could be by a man named James Strachey, translations which, for the most part, Freud himself approved. Freud was a fluent English linguist, as well as French, Italian, and two or three other languages. So I believe that Freud scholarship is on the verge of an explosion. I think the death of psychoanalysis is a bit premature, to quote, or to rephrase Mark Twain. And I think the final point of this is also important. Not only have Freud's ideas affect psychology, I think for the most part we might be able to say we are all Freudians now, whether we recognize it or not. His language has permeated our culture. His way of thinking about the mind is now so universal we hardly recognize it's Freudian. When someone says, "Oh, she's so in denial," everyone knows what it means. We understand. We understand there's something in her unconscious that can't handle the truth of something that's happened in her life. We all recognize that there's something repressed. There's something that's unconscious that is not allowing itself to become conscious and to accept the truth of the reality. These are all Freudian terms that no one understood or could think about before him. And yet today they're so commonplace that I think we've in fact forgotten where they came from. So I am not here to defend Freud. I don't believe Freud needs defending. I think his impact and power are beyond criticism and beyond defense, the need for defense at least. I challenge you, if you disagree with what you've heard about Freud, his books are now available in rather inexpensive copies. I challenge you, read him yourself and come up with your own conclusions. Freud actually warned us himself of this in 1905 at the beginning of the case of Dora. This is when Freud had just begun theorizing. His theories were very early on. And he was getting a lot of flack, especially on his theories concerning sexuality. And he was a little irritated by the criticisms from people who didn't know what he'd said. And so he wrote this: "And anyone who has hitherto been unwilling to believe that a psychosexual etiology holds good generally," that means that he believed that sexuality and childhood development were inextricably linked with modern mental illness, "is scarcely likely to be convinced by the fact of taking stock of a single case history." He said, if you don't know this material, then the odds are my case file isn't going to convince you. This is the key part here. He, the future critic, "would do better to suspend his judgment until his own work has earned him the right to a conviction." This is Freud, you might say, a little arrogant, a little confident, but also the result of his phenomenological method. And I use that word, I know it's a big word, phenomenology. This is him gathering evidence. And when I said initially it wasn't about his theories, it was about his method, this is what he meant. You may disagree with his theories, but the way to do that effectively is to immerse yourself in the method. Do your own work. Earn your own experience. And then, as he said, you have the right to an opinion. This is a grave challenge to those who criticize Freud who haven't done psychoanalytic work, who haven't been therapists, who haven't at least read his works thoroughly and carefully. Perhaps on a more gentle note, I think we might rely on a letter written by John Keats, the great British romantic poet from the 1820s. Keats said something that I think Freud would completely agree with. He said we should strive toward, as he called it, negative capability. The idea that we should suspend judgment, withhold judgment, look and think about what's in front of us, look as carefully and as thoroughly as we can at the evidence before we make up our mind. In fact, the idea is that most of us come to a decision so quickly because we're worried, because we have anxiety, because not knowing scares us in some way, and we need to come to a conclusion to overcome that anxiety more than we need the truth of whatever it is we're discovering. And so we can't wait, or we don't want to wait. And I think Freud and John Keats, the great English poet, is saying the same thing. Look at the evidence, wait, withhold judgment. Here's the question. Can you sit with not knowing and let the evidence, let the phenomenology, let the thing in front of you speak to you long enough so that the truth of it emerges in your research? If you can do that, and you can do it thoroughly, then I think Freud would find your criticism legitimate and he would listen. So, as I said, a method of looking at the mind. And here's the complicated part. What is the human mind? This is a question that poets and philosophers and psychologists have been talking for thousands of years. It troubled Plato and Aristotle 2,500 years ago. And I have to admit that I don't know the answer to the question. And even worse, and embarrassingly, my entire field does not know the answer to the question, what is the mind? No one today has moved one inch beyond Freud's warning in 1935 or 6 that we have two things. We have the brain and we have consciousness, or what we would now call the mind. And he said then, even after 40, 50 years of research, there is no direct causal link between the brain and the mind. And this is an astonishing fact. And all of our research, all of our medical science, all of our fancy scanning technologies have not moved us one inch toward understanding directly, scientifically, the direct link, the causal link between the brain and the mind. A lot of people think about correlation, but you must understand the difference between causation and correlation. One is scientific and the other is not. Scientific causation. This happens, then this, and there's a direct link. This causes this to happen, and we can see it, and we can experiment with it, and we can recreate experiments in the lab, and we can show it over and over. The great unspoken truth, frankly, in psychology is there is nothing like that in psychology. We have no ability to say this neuron, this genetic component, this constellation of neurons in the brain leads directly to this behavior or this emotion or this way of being in the world. It absolutely does not exist, and there isn't a scientist on the planet today, there isn't a neurologist anywhere who can deny that. They will talk about correlation, they will talk about, well, when this is happening in the brain, then people feel depressed. But they can't tell you whether it's the depression causing the neurological activation or whether the neurological activation is causing the depression. That's the great conundrum in my field now. People sell a lot of medication because they claim it has some causal link, but if you listen carefully, it doesn't. And I'm going to be careful throwing the word fraud around here, but I think the burden is on anyone who claims this kind of causation, who claims to know what the mind is, if they claim it's a direct and ascertainable derivative of the brain. The burden of proof is on them to prove it, because as of today, no one's gotten close to proving what Freud said couldn't be proved, though he hoped to prove it in the mid-1930s. In fact, he started out assuming that we could prove it, that the brain was the seat of the mind, and the brain is where the action was. And if we understood the brain and how it worked, we then, he hoped, could find a direct path to the mind, to human behavior, to emotions, and understanding behavior, mind, and emotions. And he wrote one of his initial texts was called The Project for a Scientific Psychology. And it was very ambitious, and it was very exciting, and it was sort of synthesizing everything he'd learned in the 1880s and 90s about the mind. He started out as a neurologist. He was dissecting brains. He was almost purely a medical scientist at that point. And unfortunately, he never could publish this article because the evidence just didn't show that it was true. And he put it in his drawer and shifted his focus, as he paid attention to his patients, to a more psychological way of thinking about the mind and a less medical, physiological one. That publication, The Project for a Scientific Psychology, was not published until after his death. There is great excitement now in my field. The neurologist, neurology, neuropsychology has now in the last 20 years with brain scans, PET scans, CAT scans, MRIs, functional MRIs, and a plethora of new types of brain scanning technologies, there's really been a revived interest in Freud's earliest work. And the idea is that we may be on the verge of actually achieving what he hoped for 120 years ago. That enthusiasm has not been met with scientific progress, again, that's so far very dramatic. We'll see. It's still too new. But in a way, you could say we're going back to the future, that the technology perhaps isn't just now allowing us to do what Freud hoped to do 120 years ago. We'll see. We'll see. So, back to Freud's earliest model, which was an energy model. He initially thought, and this comes out of the scientific model of the late 1800s, the Industrial Revolution. Everyone was thinking in terms of energy and force. And Freud initially thought that that's the way the mind worked, that it was about the transmission of energy. He wasn't sure how it was being transmitted. The neuron had just been discovered. It was very exciting. So they assumed that energy was being transferred around, and that really was how the mind worked within the brain. And they assumed that if there was a mental illness, it was because energy was being dammed up. Maybe there was a trauma that was stopping the easy flow of energy. And so therapy was about going back into the mind, the memory, the history, the developmental history, and trying to unblock the energy flow caused by trauma. That was Freud's initial theory. And if you could unblock that trauma through, he called it this catharsis release of the cathartic release of the energy, then you would restore mental functioning and the brain would be restored to its normal energy flow. Fabulous theory. Fabulous theory. It's consistent with all the theories of the day. It just didn't work. Freud could not prove his theory with consistent healing of patients. His patients, unfortunately, didn't get better all the time with using this method, this going back into their history and this cathartic release of energy. He couldn't find the energy. He couldn't see it. He couldn't measure it. He sort of assumed it was there and he was looking for it. But unfortunately, the phenomenology, the evidence, simply didn't support this theory. So Freud did what his great teacher Charcot taught him to do. Follow the evidence. Change the theories. And this perhaps is a lesson for modern thinkers. And it was almost unique in Europe at the time. If a psychologist or a neurologist or a doctor saw a patient and that patient's physiology or emotional stance didn't follow the doctor's theory, well, why, it was obviously the patient's problem, the patient's fault. They were resisting. They weren't doing something right. They were lying. They were probably malingering. They were pretending. Whatever the result, it couldn't be that our wonderful theories were somehow mistaken. Freud was the first one to say, no, if the evidence isn't there, it's probably our theoretical problem. And he changed his theories. And this is how he operated. This was his method his entire career. If the evidence doesn't fit the theory, change the theory. Pay attention to and stay with the phenomenology, the evidence. Charcot, he was a French physician, who Freud studied with during his medical residency. He had a great saying. Some young student came to him one time and said, "Well, Dr. Charcot, this thing that you said, it can't exist because the theory doesn't support it." And Charcot looked at him very gently and said, "Young man, theories are nice, but they don't stop things from existing. And Freud was very fond of quoting Charcot on that exact point over and over in his life. Theories are nice, but they don't stop things from existing. And the job of the psychologist, the job of the psychotherapist, was to make sure they understood what was existing in front of them in the minds of their patients, not making their patients fit with whatever pet theory the therapist has. So, what Freud did when his theories didn't work was that he stopped theorizing and started looking more closely. He stopped theorizing and listened more carefully to his patients. And what he discovered early on, and this was shocking to a scientist, is that he discovered the unconscious. Now, he wasn't the first one to think about unconscious things. Again, the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche had talked at length about how the human is a thing dark and veiled, that there's things going on about our minds we do not know. Philosophers and poets had been talking about things like that for centuries, millennia even. But Freud was the first one to really realize, I think, the depth, the power, and the significance of the unconscious. In fact, he actually coined a phrase, a psychic reality, that he postulated an unconscious mind, an unconscious dynamic, an unconscious reality that was powerful, pervasive, and to which the conscious mind had very little immediate access, if any. And he saw that people's behaviors could not be explained by reason, could not be explained by their understanding of reality, that in fact the human mind at its unconscious levels, in psychic reality, really actually explained people's behavior a lot more than how they rationalized things. He realized we weren't a rational creature. We were in fact rationalizing more than we were rational. And this opened up amazing possibilities for therapy. If patients came in and told us a story and we believed them factually, as if that was in fact the exact truth, what Freud realized is that we missed perhaps everything of importance about what was really going on in their minds. And so he had to be careful. He had to listen carefully. He had to put together associations in their patterns of thinking and feeling and experiencing. And this led him to help the patient recognize their own unconscious dynamic. And he received all kinds of criticism for this. This was unacceptable. This was the end of the Enlightenment era, where men and women and thinkers and scientists had been carving out 200 or 300 years of science and reason in the face of myth and the Dark Ages and religious intolerance. And the fantasy was that we had this new era of rational debate and scientism, and it was going to solve all the world's problems. And Freud was unfortunately in a position to say no to that, that the things weren't quite that simple. And perhaps if that's the way they were, it would be great, but the human mind is not quite that rational. And I think what he found that upset most people was that we are sexual creatures almost from birth, and that our desires and our instincts and our sexuality and our aggression tied to these unconscious dynamics made us not masters of our lives in some ways. There were things about us that were difficult to square with our morality and our vision and our ideologies and our desires, our own conscious fantasies of the world we wanted and who we thought we are. And so Freud came in for quite vicious criticism very early on. In fact, the truth is his ideas were so radical, he was all but thrown out of the medical community. No one even wanted to hang out with him. He wasn't invited to conferences. One of the most momentous moments was after he presented in 1905 his three essays on sexuality, where he laid down the childhood precursors to adult sexuality, laid out the idea that in very, very rudimentary forms, and it's important to recognize that, in very rudimentary forms, even very young children have some kind of sexualized fantasy life, some sort of sexualized ideas. Not very well worked out, not sophisticated, not like adult ideas of sexuality, of course, but sexual nonetheless. And this horrified the Victorian European ideologies of the time. the European expert on sexuality and perversion at the time and sexual dysfunction was a powerful man named Krafft Ebing, doctor, Herr Doctor, Professor Krafft Ebing. And he was imperious and arrogant and full of himself. And everyone thought he was the boss on this area. And he listened. He was in the audience when Freud first presented these theories. And at the end, it is said that he turned to one of his colleagues and loud enough for everyone to hear, said, "It seems like a scientific fairy tale to me," and got up and walked out and basically dismissed Freud out of hand. And it took Freud almost 10 years to recover his reputation in the European medical community. Did Freud make mistakes? Yes. And his biggest one was not about sexuality, but about aggression. He probably was right 100 and so years later about the power and importance of sexuality. This is one of those moments where we can look around us now and try to challenge Freud's idea that sexuality is really driving our train. I don't think anybody who spends 5 minutes today watching television or going to movies or walking past a magazine stand can deny the power of sexuality. I think he was right about that, and probably more right than even we're willing to admit today in our sexually drenched culture. He did make a mistake, however, about aggression. It took him until he was 72 years old or even older to recognize the power and importance of aggression. Initially, for the first 20 or 30 years of his theorizing, he assumed that everything was about sexuality. That was revolutionary enough, and few in his milieu could handle that thought. But this was a prejudice that Freud had. He was a pacifist. He was from a Jewish cultural milieu that was really quite peaceful and pacifist, if not outright pacifist. And so the evidence in front of him of aggression, he could not see well, even after living through World War I. And I think that was really the impetus. Even he could not deny the power of aggression after that, and still it took him another 10 or 15 years to recognize its importance. He initially thought that there was something like, there must be a death instinct. He thought initially, given his energy theory, that if there was a life instinct, if there was libido, he called it, if there was this life energy coursing around, and people were still killing themselves and hurting themselves and doing bad things to each other, well, that wouldn't be consistent with a life instinct, so there must be something else. There must be, let's see, if there's a life instinct doing all these good things, there must be a death instinct. He had an energy theory, he had an instinct theory, and this was his conclusion. Now, he was wrong about that, but he was right about the evidence. He was right about the phenomenology. He saw things going around him that weren't consistent with his libido, were not consistent with his libido theory, and so he postulated another theory, death instinct. Well, that wouldn't be consistent with evolution, he saw eventually, and so he tended to use aggression or aggressive theories to supplement his idea of libido or life energy or sexuality. It did take him a long time to make that correction. And we are still, I think, making that correction today. We still hate aggression. We still think aggression is bad. We are now, in the last 20 years, teaching our young boys in junior high school and high school not to play dodgeball, not to play tag, because it's just, oh, too aggressive. And that feels like something is wrong. And there's a very serious problem with that we'll talk about later when we come to sort of the cultural manifestations of pathology. But what I find is both around the questions of sexuality and aggression, the questions that Freud struggled with are still the questions we are struggling with today, and we must get over our modernist prejudice. People today, wrongly, think that if someone didn't write the article yesterday, it isn't worth reading, that only the modern is worth reading. And the truth is, when it comes to the mind, because we do not have a scientific agreement about what the mind even is, that insights by great, smart men and women who struggled with these issues 10, 20, 30, 100 years ago remain powerful sources of wisdom for us and should not be poo-pooed just because they're a decade or so old. reading Freud, reading some of his immediate co-workers, reading the men and women that came after him in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and more recently, seemed to me to still be the source of great wisdom and useful information for which we can help our patients with if we are clinicians, we can understand our own minds with if we study them diligently, and we can certainly help each other, not to mention our families. So, let's go back to the original discoveries. In 1905, Freud made, in addition to this method of thinking about mental development, he discovered something that most people put among his most profound discoveries, and that's what he called the transference. Now, sounds kind of mystical, but it's not. It's really quite simple. He understood for the first time that the human mind is a function of its development, that we do not, as children, spring into the world fully formed, that there is a long, slow developmental process. Now, when I say that to most modern audience, it's an obvious thing. Everyone understands child development now, but no one did in Freud's day. This is another one of those issues that Freud discovered that has become so much a part of our culture, we have a hard time recognizing where it came from. Freud understood that we slowly accrue experience, that we go through developmental phases, and those phases remain with us. And it turns out that when we become adults, even adolescents, we do not respond to the world honestly, objectively, scientifically, that there's something about this accumulated experience within us that is part of how we react, that we perceive the world not objectively or scientifically. We perceive the world through the lens of our own experience, our own previous perceptions that are now in part repressed into our unconscious, in part actively alive in our conscious minds. And I don't want to get esoteric. This is really quite simple. An example, a clinical example that you all can understand and relate to. Let's say your father was a harsh disciplinarian, an authoritarian kind of guy, and you put up with that and dealt with that and suffered under that in some ways your entire childhood until you could get out and go to school and get a job and become your own person. And let's say you do that and you go out in the world and you get your first real job and you move into your apartment and you're independent now, independent and autonomous of that authoritarian upbringing. And what happens? You show up on the first day of work and it turns out your boss is exactly that kind of an authoritarian person, and he walks by your desk and says, "Bigelow, what the hell's wrong with you? Your desk is a mess. Clean it up or I'm going to fire you. What kind of nonsense is this on the first day?" And he storms out. Now, what's your response? If that's you sitting there at the desk, what's your response? Do you look around your desk and realize, my goodness, it is too messy for the first day. I'm going to have to get on this. Or do you really respond with a volcano of anger and rage? How dare he? How dare he? Things that you probably thought, or at least wanted to think, in your earliest childhood against exactly that sort of experience at the hands of your father. You, in the moment your boss confronts you that way, you transfer feelings repressed into the unconscious. You transfer the memory, the experience, the unconscious reality, in psychic reality, of those reactions, responses that you've had your whole life. And guess what? Unless you understand psychic reality, unless you get that anger, unless you have the strength to contain it, you are very likely to lose that job because you're overreacting. You're not reacting to him honestly, objectively, scientifically. You're reacting to him with the full force of the transference. And this, Freud realized, was the most powerful vehicle for understanding how a mind has become what it is, and the most powerful way that possibly we might intervene therapeutically to help that person understand his or her mind. So, transference is not always negative. Anybody ever fell in love? Anybody ever fell in love at first sight? How do you explain that? Freud explained it this way. It's transference. You have good things in you. You have bad things in you. You have anger, aggression, emotion, intensity, rage, insecurity, love, desire, joy. All of these things are the accumulated experiences of your unique entire life. And when you see something good, it also may resonate with those good things in you. And you respond how? Objectively, scientifically? Not at all. You respond with the transference of good things so that you see something and it, you respond not to the person, really. You're responding to your own inner feeling, your own psychic reality. I love her. I love him. Though they're Prince Charming or the princess. See, it's so obvious. But Freud understood, and we now understand, that more often than not, perhaps almost always, when we feel those feelings, they're really about us. They're about our accumulated experience, good or bad, being evoked, as Freud said, in the transference. And we must be aware of that, because if we act in the real world, based not on the real world, but on our own emotional constructs, we will go wrong. How many times have you fallen in love and been disappointed, discovered only so sadly too late that the person you fell in love with wasn't that person you thought they were initially? How could you have been so mistaken? How many of us have asked that question? Let me think. All of us at some point or another. This is a way to understand how we can be so mistaken. This is a way, if we understand this dynamic, to perhaps shield ourselves from making those kinds of mistakes again. This feels really important. Freud realized that if we, in our lives, repeat the transference in our other lives, the odds are the patient was going to repeat the transference in the therapy. And Freud realized that made it the key to therapeutic improvement. That made it the key to healing old wounds and helping people get strong enough to understand the details of their minds and lives. And so the therapeutic method of Freud began slowly inching toward a way of interacting with the patient that allowed the patient to see how the patient, him or herself, was treating the therapist like a figure from their past, like the authoritarian father, like the nurturing mother. Whether they were male or female, it didn't seem to matter. And to be able for the therapist to point, oh, look how you just responded there. But that's not me. That's something you brought. I didn't say that. That's something that you seem to feel without my participation. And the patient then realizes, oh my God, that's something about me. And some part of their unconscious, some part of their psychic reality comes into their conscious mind. And in those moments, there's incredible power. There's incredible realization of who they are and how they've become who they are. And then some ability to deal with reality in a more effective way. Freud, I think, fell upon, by paying careful attention, this perhaps most important therapeutic attempt, this is a therapeutic issue, the transference in the here and now with the therapist as the best and most useful vehicle for therapeutic change. How do we get there? How did we get to transference? Well, I think before that, Freud realized in his understanding of the unconscious that, wait a minute, how did the unconscious get formed? We have to ask that question. And he came up with the idea of repression. The unconscious got filled, how? With things that used to be conscious that we didn't want, could not tolerate. That old movie, A Few Good Men, Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson, the famous actors in it. At one point, Tom Cruise yells at the Jack Nicholson character, "I want the truth!" And Jack Nicholson looks back and yells just as loud, "You can't handle the truth!" And when I saw it the first time, I thought, oh my God, he's right. For the most part, we can't handle the truth. We have repressed the truth that we could not handle into our own conscious. And that Freud saw early on was what makes up a large part of our psychic reality. It's not just forgetting. It's motivated forgetting. It's not, as Freud said, about not wanting to know these things, these feelings, these experiences in our past. It's about not wanting to know them. Perhaps I would put not being strong enough to know them, not being able to contain the anxiety that being conscious of them would force us to recognize and confront. And again, a common example that shows there's something to this. If a woman is married and with a man, and the rumor is he's cheating on her, and all his friends know it and all her friends know it, but she's in denial. Why is she in denial? Why would she be in denial? because to recognize the truth of it would be so devastating, would evoke so much anxiety, would destroy her life, and she can't handle that truth, doesn't want to go there, so she represses, she denies. A defense mechanism, denial, using it to repress that knowledge. She doesn't want to know. She isn't strong enough to know until the evidence is simply overwhelming, and by then it's often way too far to fix much. So we have repression as a key Freudian idea. We have the power of early developmental sexuality and the late discovered power of aggression. And also the therapeutic utility of transference and the idea that we live in the transference. This is the important idea. This isn't just a once-in-a-while thing between friends and lovers or between therapists and patients. It appears to be the nature of how we walk around. We live in the transference. We see nothing cleanly and obviously and objectively. Everything we see is translated through this internalized psychic reality, which is, again, the sum total of our childhood experiences. This is frustrating to people. We don't want to believe that. We want to believe that we see the reality of life. We want to believe that our political beliefs, our religious beliefs, our relationships are true and honest and real, and we're rational creatures in charge of our destinies. And there is much evidence that says those things are not true. And there is a tendency for most of us to believe them anyway, and that's interesting and useful if you're strong enough to look at it carefully. Why don't we? Why don't we look at it strong? Why don't we look at the evidence in front of us carefully enough? And Freud said the defense mechanisms. Everybody knows the idea of denial or now repression. There's probably 15, 20 different ideas that clinicians have come up with over the years to describe different ways that the mind represses anxiety, deals with anxiety. You can project it. If I'm angry at my boss for being such an authoritarian, I can go home and kick the dog or yell at my wife. We can displace it. We can project it onto somebody else. We can split. We can pretend all the bad is over there and all the good is over there. We don't need to go through all of the defense mechanisms now, but just this idea that we tend to gravitate toward defense mechanisms that work for us. Because Freud also recognized, and this is one of his most profound insights as well, that we are conflicted creatures. It's sad but true. We're not unified. We're riven with conflicts within us. We want things. We don't allow ourselves to have things. We need things. It's forbidden. It seems that our mind is compartmented. We are a multiplicity of souls, Nietzsche said. And one of my favorite quotes from the great American poet Walt Whitman, and again, poets seem to be on this better than psychologists ever were. Walt Whitman, if you're familiar with his poetry from the late 1800s, probably the greatest American poet of all time, someone accused him of being contradictory. And he was. And he was a big man, and he was full of life and full of energy. And he was an artist and a poet, and he wasn't much concerned with consistency. And when he was accused of contradicting himself, at one point he said, "Contradict myself? Well, very well then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes." And the first time I read that, I thought, well, that's all Freud ever said. That we do have, if not multitudes, we have a lot of pushing and hauling. And even in our culture, there are not stereotypes, but there are little truisms that we seem to recognize. You've all heard of the little idea of the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other sort of whispering in our ears. We feel that way. We feel pulled between desire. We feel pulled between need, between reality and wanting and fearing. And I think if we stop for a minute, we all see that's just obviously true. Freud took what he saw as obviously true in front of him and tried to explain the nuts and bolts of it, the mechanics of it, how that worked in our unconscious, and try to develop a method for helping people overcome those dynamics, that you're not stuck in those contradictions. You can get out of those conflicts that really tear our minds apart in some ways. And in fact, that's what he discovered, that mental illness is the result of these conflicts that freeze us, that make it impossible for us to do anything because we've repressed or denied. We're in such conflict, their energy that we would love to spend in creativity is now being spent repressing and denying all of these terrible conflicts. The resolution of those conflicts, the bringing to consciousness of them, the understanding of their developmental trajectory is what therapy became all about for a long time. The management of anxiety, the understanding of the defense mechanisms, the dealing with and resolving and understanding the conflicts that pervade our life, that go back to our earliest childhood. And we'll come to this later, but the earliest conflict, what's the earliest conflict a baby has? I want the breast. It's not here. Why not? Well, it must be bad, or my mother's bad, or I'm angry, or I'm bad. Maybe mother's not feeding me because it's my fault. These psychic conflicts in young children generate terrible difficulties for them, and we have to understand that. And those conflicts generate defense mechanisms that are with us to this day. So Freud understood that from the beginning we are drenched in the conflicts that life brings us as human. This is why great Greek tragedians wrote tragedies. This is the human condition. This is human nature. And Freud was grounded in that in what seems like a very mature way. He wasn't delusional. He wasn't an ideologist who could pretend we could reach utopia. He thought being human meant grounded in exactly this sort of unpleasant reality, and the best we could do is struggle with it, struggle against these conflicts, struggle against these defense mechanisms, struggle against psychic reality in a painful way sometimes. No way around that, he thought. And he was not optimistic about what psychoanalysis could do. He was humble about it. He saw the great power of the unconscious. He saw the limitations most human beings are up against, and took the position that small changes are heroic, that little bits of improvement through lots of difficult therapy is probably the best we can hope for. And people have criticized him as being sort of arrogant, and I don't read a shred of arrogance in him. I think at the end of his life, he was quite humbled by 50 years of research into the human mind. And I think he would agree that the human mind is complicated, that we have these biological impulses. We have fantasies, unconscious fantasies. We have memories of experiences, good and bad, trauma and joy. We have our own desires in the here and now. We have our own desires going back a long ways. We have our own motives. We have our own belief systems that drive us in many contradictory ways. And so I think you put all of those together, and what you see in Freud is the power of the unconscious, the power of unconscious fantasy, the necessity of seeing the truth of that, resisting Jack Nicholson's, you can't handle the truth. The question is, can we handle the truth? Can we endure the truth of our own minds and achieve a certain courageous depth of understanding? That's the possibility that Freud held out with his method. Let's take a break now. Thank you.